Northwestern Medicine, relentless in their pursuit of better health care. Learn more at nm.org/better.
Time for a look at the week in health. And joining us again by popular demand, Dr. Jeremy Silver, the medical director of emergency medicine at Northwestern's Kishwaukee Hospital in DeKalb. Dr. Silver, how are you, my friend? Welcome back to the show.
Oh, good morning, Dean. Thanks for having me again. I appreciate it.
You going to be watching the Super Bowl today?
Yes, my kids are very excited, and so am I. It's nice to have this time of year again, and we love football, so pretty pumped for the Super Bowl.
Now, as a doctor, when you're watching the show, are you pointing out potential injuries, you know, and things that could be happening? There is a lot of criticism of how physical the game is, certainly on high school level, college level. That's where, you know, most of the scrutiny is. But are you watching that and going, ooh, that looked like that could have been a...
Yeah, can you diagnose from the screen?
Sometimes you can. You definitely like to play that game when you're in med school of walk down the street and diagnose the person. But I'll tell you that I try to shut my medical brain off when I'm at home, especially when I'm around my kids. But when I see a big hit, like a hit to the head, it makes you queasy inside because you just know what the potential is for head and neck injuries in those types of collisions.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you know, today is one of the biggest party days of the year. A lot of people, the biggest trend now, people calling out sick for tomorrow because they're planning on going overboard for today. It's become one of the biggest party days of the year. What kind of caution can you give people for who may be overindulging a little bit today, especially as an emergency room doctor?
Yeah, I mean, I on the one hand, you know, we're here for it and ready for folks if they, you know, end up going over the line. But you know, it's not safe. You can really actually hurt yourself, and you know, it can be lethal overindulging in alcohol. But you know, as far as work goes, hey, we all committed to be there for each other. So I'm definitely not in favor of playing hooky.
Yeah, as far as overindulging, I've always heard, you know, for New Year's Eve or like the big party day, St. Patrick's Day, et cetera, to alternate whatever alcoholic beverage that you may have with water to try to stay hydrated. That's the big thing that you ought to be doing today. Does that sound like good advice?
Yeah, I think one for one is definitely not a bad idea. So if you're going to reach for a beer, you know, have a nice glass of water afterwards. It'll fill your stomach up and make you less likely to continue pushing the alcohol. But you know, really, it's moderation. Everything in moderation. That's my motto. I didn't make it up, but I certainly live by it.
Yeah, no, it's always good advice, even though a lot of people are definitely not going to follow it. So a couple of the big medical stories this week that I wanted to touch on. One, it was the very untimely death of country singer Toby Keith, who lost his battle earlier last week to stomach cancer. And it's not a cancer that we hear about very often. How prevalent is stomach cancer? How do people know if they, you know, might be dealing with something like that? Can you give us, you know, kind of an overview of dealing with stomach cancer?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, sad to hear. I'm sorry that had happened. So stomach cancer is not a high, it's not high up on the list in terms of, you know, the numbers of cancers in the U.S. Around a percentage and a half of all cancers diagnosed in the U.S. and typically in adults greater than 50. So this year, the American Cancer Society estimates around 27,000 new cases of cancer, just to give a number. But something that we're seeing, and certainly folks are probably reading about this in the news, is that there are rising numbers of stomach cancer among younger people. And so it's, you know, one could look at it as a disease of bad luck, as one physician has referred to it. There may be some association with chronic heartburn and an infection in the gut called H. pylori, which I can talk about a little bit more, but unclear. And there are certain ethnic groups, such as Asians, who are more prone to stomach cancer for a variety of reasons, genetically primarily. And unfortunately, even though it's rare, the outcomes are typically not great. So it's certainly not a disease that anyone relishes, and something that you need specialty treatment for, surely.
Yeah, you mentioned H. pylori. What is that?
So H. pylori is a bacteria that lives in the gut in many folks and can cause an infection that can lead to symptoms of GERD or gastroesophageal reflux disease, otherwise known as heartburn. And I'm not sure what the percentage is, but a significant percentage of cases of heartburn or ulcers can be linked back to that bacteria. And there's a thought that potentially the inflammation stemming from a chronic infection of the bacteria that isn't identified could potentially lead to cancer. Cancer, just to take a step back, 50,000-foot view, what is it? It's an overgrowth of cells in the body. So you have one cell that basically cells have a life cycle and they divide in a certain cadence. So as as you're going through life, your skin cells are falling off as you touch things and move about the world. Likewise, your stomach cells are sloughing off or falling off as you're eating food and digesting, and then new cells come and take their place. Well, cancer is a dysregulation of that cell division, which continually repeats itself, and it gets out of control. The brake, if you will, on the car fails. Alternatively, the accelerator on the car gets stuck. So between the brake and the accelerator and the cell, if one or both are dysfunctional, then the cell is just dividing uncontrolled in a crazy manner, and then you get a huge collection of irregular cells that do things that aren't predictable, and that's cancer.
You mentioned that some of the symptoms may present themselves as good old heartburn, acid reflux. How do you know the difference between something that is mild and something that could be potentially very dangerous?
Well, a great question, and this will be very frustrating for your audience, as it is for us in the medical profession. You often can't tell the difference between something that seems like a run-of-the-mill benign case of heartburn and something that might be more sinister, like a cancer. And so the key is, don't let the symptoms go on too long. If you're one of these folks that every time you have pizza, you get a little bit uncomfortable, you have a Tums, and it's better, probably not cancer. On the other hand, if you've been kind of going along in your life doing fine, then suddenly you find you're having heartburn for weeks or months, that might be a problem. So pattern recognition would be one thing. And then, of course, regular follow-up with primary care is so important. I know it can be tough to get into your primary care doctor given the demand at the present time, but very important, stay in tune or get referred to a specialist, the specialist of the gut, meaning the esophagus, the stomach, the upper intestines, and the lower intestines is a person called a GI doctor, a gastroenterologist, and they're very skilled at identifying the subtleties between these conditions and helping fix them.
The 630 area code texts in a question. Please ask the doctor about reactions to Paxlovid. I've taken 3 doses and have experienced a constant bad taste to the point where I can't even think about taking it without nausea. That's something that I haven't heard about Paxlovid. Is that the case?
Thank you for the question. Any drug can have side effects, and unfortunately, bad taste is one of them. Now, in the Paxlovid trials, about 1% or less had that side effect. It's certainly not a common side effect, but it can happen. The thing to do is basically what I would suggest if they were my patient is, first of all, check in with your doctor. There may be other symptoms the person's having that are accompanying this that may be a red flag to stop the medication. Alternatively, that this may be linked to something else and it's timing with the Paxlovid, but very likely it's a symptom of the medication, and probably the thing to do is to stop it and talk to your doctor.
Okay, 773-981-7200 is our phone number for your questions for Dr. Silver. 312-981-7200 to call in a question or to text. 773 area code. We get questions like this all the time during the segment about, what I should be doing about vaccinations. COVID, flu shots, RSV. What's the latest and greatest on all of this? Where should people be to be up to date with vaccinations?
Sure. So, vaccination, obviously a hot button issue, a very personal issue. What I can tell folks, I'll talk generally and then I'll talk specific. So generally, what is a vaccine? A vaccine is generally a killed version of the pathogen. So let's say it's a virus. They kill the virus and make it dysfunctional, and then inject it into the body and usually in the muscle of the arm. And then what happens is the body, the immune system, sees that pieces of particles of that pathogen and identifies it and says, guys, the next time you see anything that looks like this, kill it. And so the body develops these soldiers, if you will, to use the war analogy. And those soldiers kind of lie kind of ready for action in little pockets of the immune system that we call lymph nodes. And they're all over the body, in the head and neck, in the arms, the belly, the groin, and even the legs. And so then months later, let's say, your immune system is primed, and you encounter, let's say it's RSV, and you've had the vaccine, it immediately triggers this massive response. The Marines, the Air Force, the Navy, the Army, of your body then goes and attacks the thing, and it helps prevent you from getting sicker. In some cases, it can prevent illness entirely, but in most cases, it's not gonna prevent you from getting sick, but it's gonna prevent you from getting really sick. And in the case of the most recent vaccine for COVID, for instance, it's very effective against the most widely circulating version, the JN.1. And it's effective against severe infection, such as needing to be in the ICU or be intubated. So not too late. Certainly flu is still circulating. So is RSV. So is COVID. I wouldn't say we're in a triple-demic at this point in time. The numbers are going down, but flu is actually still quite prevalent. So number one, it's good for you. Number two, it's good for grandma, because we know the elderly don't have the same robust immune response that folks in their younger years do. And so if you're around the elderly or a brand new baby, for instance, their immune safety net is really you. And so it's a collective thing. It's something we refer to sometimes as herd immunity. When there's enough people that have either been sick and develop a natural immune response, which is very similar to the immunization response, and those of us that have been immunized, we protect those that are vulnerable, those with immunocompromised conditions such as cancer or lupus, those that are elderly, and those that are in the very beginnings of life, in their infancy, literally. So vaccines are very effective, and they're effective against a variety of viruses and bacteria.
Last week, we had talked about the number of, just general fitness and the number of steps that a person should be doing daily in order to maintain, a proper health level. And you had some follow-up on the number of steps that you think people should be taking each day.
Right. Thanks for bringing that up. I want to say that I stand corrected. I maybe misspoke or certainly have learned something since we last talked. So there was a study out of Northwestern that looked at folks and the number of steps. And to summarize it, if you're over 60, it looks like the number is 6,000, that there was a significant reduction in cardiovascular incidents, so things like stroke and heart attack, in people over 60 who were walking 6,000 steps compared to less. And so it didn't really apply to anybody under 60. And there's still some questions about what the right number is, but I would stick to what I said before. More is better. But that number 6,000, if you're over 60, you may want to keep that in your head and try and shoot for that.
Yeah. I was just, checking my, you know, how your phone, you know, checks, you know, supposedly reads your steps and, all that. Let me see how I'm doing so far today.
72 today.
I've done virtually nothing today. So. Oh, this is embarrassing. I've taken four.
Not even 72.
According to my stupid phone, 401 steps today.
That's okay.
That's nothing.
Well, you only have.
Well, you're a certain percentage of the way there. So you know, look on the bright side.
Yeah, 50. Only 5,500 more to go.
Apparently, I'm going to be walking to Milwaukee after the show today.
Go to Kishwaukee.
Yeah, go to Kishwaukee and visit Dr. Silver. Yeah, exactly. The 407 area code. There are long waits to see primary care and specialist doctors right now. Why is that? Is there a general shortage of physicians? I've wondered that myself. I've noticed that trying to make appointments as well.
Yes, the answer is yes. I think it can safely be said that at a large percentage of the primary care, well, not a large, but a significant percentage of the primary care physician population has been peeling off, particularly since the pandemic hit. And not enough of those slots are being filled by medical students for a variety of reasons. And so there are fewer primary care doctors. I think there's also more of an awareness in society that this is an important piece of care. And so more people are seeking care. And so that supply and demand equation is way off. So what they're feeling is real. The numbers bear it out. And it's unfortunate. I guess the only thing I would say is, you know, there's still a safety net in the emergency department. We don't turn anyone away ever. And so if you can't get in and you're really concerned, you can always come to the ER and we can at least try and help. And if we can't figure it out, we can at least try and coordinate care and maybe get that appointment pushed up.
Yeah. It's a tricky times, really, since COVID, getting appointments. But emergency room is a good option. And these first responder offices now, the medical attention offices, the
urgent care.
Urgent care, right. You can go right into those. So I also wanted to ask you about memory because.
But I forgot to ask.
That I almost forgot to bring it up. It's obviously headline news right now. It's clearly going to be an issue with the presidential campaign that's coming up. President Biden is 81 years old. Donald Trump is 77 years old. There's been lots of heat on President Biden about misstatements that he's made. There have also been some about Donald Trump being made right now as well regarding memory. How common is that? I've noticed that. I'm not nearly either of their ages, but I forget. I'm forgetting more now than I have when I was younger. Is that just, you know, part of the natural process? And when does it actually become a concern?
Yeah, great questions, and no easy answers, that's for sure. I'm going to stay out of the political debate.
Yes.
But I will say that, it's disconcerting. 40% of us are going to experience some form of memory loss after we turn 65. That's a huge number. Where it becomes a problem is when you can actually be diagnosed with an underlying process such as Alzheimer's dementia, which we've spoken of before, the most common form of dementia. Dementia being the disease of memory loss. Between the ages of 65 and 69, 2 in every 100 people will have dementia, and then after that, your risk increases over time, roughly doubles every 5 years, so that by the time if you reach 90, a third of people will have dementia. Honestly, it seems like the numbers are higher than that, but that's the data. So, you know, the key is functionality. And so it's obviously going to be difficult to diagnose in yourself, and denial is an extremely, strong, component of the human psyche. And so even if you do see that you're missing a step here and there, your brain is going to want to, limit the risk for itself and say, you know, that's fine. It was just a slip. So it really applies to the folks around you. You know, if mom or dad is having trouble finding out how to get home in their car, or they can't remember where they put their keys, and it persistently is a problem. You know, things like mapping, memory of people in the family, if they couldn't remember who your sister was, and that happens more than once. You know, those would be triggers to get them checked out by a neurologist to see if maybe there truly is dementia at play.
Dr. Jeremy Silver, Medical Director, Emergency Medicine, Northwestern's Kishwaukee Hospital in DeKalb. Great to talk to you, and I hope you have a wonderful Sunday today, my friend. Thank you.
Dean, great to talk to you again. Thanks for having me on the